You're listening to The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, Tasmania's largest independent pop culture retailer. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Good evening, everybody. This is the Dice Men Cometh, talking to you all about these board games, these card games, all the fun things you can play on tabletops. And this is our 226th episode.
Woohoo!
On this Thursday, the 23rd. And lads, have you guys had a fun day?
No, I've been at work.
Oh,
I mean, yes, I love work.
Cool. Mark, are you also the same?
Yeah, I've been at work and sort of trying to watch out of the corner of my eye what's happening in Australian politics, but who can work that out?
Oh, who cares about that? It's boring anyway. Makes no effect on our life whatsoever.
Exactly. What did, Leon, you sound like you want to tell us what you've been up to today.
I went down to a place in Tasmania called Redbanks where we did some crazy manly things like shooting guns and throwing axes and all that kind of jazz. And I just wanted to show how board games can affect your logical thinking and your decision making, because there was one game of paintball which the team that I was on, we set a bit of a record.
Really?
Yes, it was a special game where there was two different sides. One was defending, one was attacking, and our attacking side, we had to get a fake bomb onto an old van. Then after that, we had to get a backpack from a storage shed and run it back to our special area. And I said to him, I said, what's stopping me going straight for that backpack, waiting for them to yell, the bomb's on the bus, grabbing it and running straight away? And the guy said, no one's ever done it, but there's no reason why you can't. And I went, that's what I'm doing. And the game was over in about 20 seconds.
Boring.
Just to show you that intelligence these board games will do, they'll make you with all the thinking and the cognitive and the planning and the, all that kind of stuff. I'm going with that.
And there you go.
and let's not go with the stupid thing I did, which was having my finger on a loaded shotgun and it going off instantly, which is apparently one of the stupidest things I've ever seen.
Yes.
But,
but no one got hurt.
No?
You have as many limbs now as you did when you started the day.
Indeed.
So congratulations.
Indeed you do. So, Garthy boy, what are we doing on the show this evening?
Oh, my goodness. We are not talking about one, but we are talking about two, three, four, five, six, maybe 10 games today, depending on how our conversation goes. We're going to start with a relatively new game that we've just been able to get to the table a couple of times this week, which is all about growing paranoia and do you trust me and do I trust you and
no,
who wants to sleep with me? So anyway, we'll get to that. Leon, then you want to talk about some games that they're based on TV or they're based on movies.
Yeah, all those things that the kids are into these days.
Yeah, some form of modern communication. Then Mark's going to wrap this all up with our latest toe-dipping experience of coin games.
Oh, yeah.
Where we get to relive the Cuban Revolution. Now, it must be said that this week we are proudly sponsored by Area 52, just in case anyone had forgotten. But we have got so much jam going on in this jam-packed show. We better put on a jam, hey, Mark?
We will.
We are the Dice Men Cometh, Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
Some good old Aussie rock there with Cold Chisel, hands out of my pocket here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
You are so current with your musical selection, Mark.
That's right. It's all about what tracks I've got in my collection that are 2 minutes-ish here on Edge Radio. With the Dice Men Cometh, of course, being Thursday night. And that's also the night you can go in and do a bit of a late-night shopping. In fact, you can do that most nights at Area 52 for your cards, your board games. I wonder if they've got any of those new fancy magic decks yet. I've heard that's what the kids are doing.
What they don't have today is their comics. They did a post on Facebook saying no comics delivered today. Oh, and normally Thursday is comic book day.
I went in there yesterday or the day before and bought some anyway. So there you go. It's fine.
Well, I guess if you were walking down the street and you looked in the door of Area 52, you might ask, who goes there?
Well, that's usually what the owners actually say whenever someone walks in the door. Because they do get lots of people going in there and they don't just know everybody by face. It's not just us. But look, that was a perfect segue, Mark.
Thank you, Garth.
Because that leads us seamlessly and professionally into what we have been playing this week, which is indeed Who Goes There by Certifiable Games, which is primarily made up of Anthony Coffey and Jess Lab, or maybe Labé.
Possibly.
This is and was an horrendously successful Kickstarter. It managed to take over $600,000 out of over 6,500 backers. And the reason they spent all their money is because it sounds so cool. It's a game where you get to replay the paranoia, the fear, the downright paranoia and fear of the thing.
Yes.
Now, the game is based on the 1938 novella, conveniently called Who Goes There?
Yes.
Garth, I have heard that that is actually one of the finest science fiction stories ever written by John W. Campbell.
Well, you were there when it was released, weren't you?
Garth.
You were his editor, weren't you?
I was the thing he was talking about.
I think you were the inspiration.
Yeah. Plucky young upstart.
But I guess most people would have sort of known The Thing from the 1982 movie.
Of course.
The Thing.
John Carpenter.
Exactly. Now,
with Kurt Russell and head crabs.
Correct. Yeah. Now, The Thing was a really important and powerful movie, and it was a bit of fun, a bit of horror, and a bit of scariness. According to IMDb, I think it only made about 20 million US at the box office.
I think it's probably made a few DVD and VHS sales.
Possibly.
Something tells me.
But look, this game is all about how I don't trust you guys.
Okay.
And how you should trust me, because I'm not vulnerable, I'm completely fine. It is a game that says it plays around about the two-hour mark. It does play minimum three, maximum six players. Now, the base game, which you could just get, comes with four characters. But if you did pay for the deluxe version of this game, which so many backers did on Kickstarter, you would get an additional four. Plus, you would get a sweet full box of sweet loot and amazingly cool inserts and pretty amazing art. And it must be said, the art is done by the same people who did the game.
Yeah.
It looks amazing when it hits the table, this game. And, Mark, you can talk about all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And we'll talk about how the minis look amazing because our mate Aiden painted the minis and makes them look amazing. But what is this game? This game is played out over somewhere between 15 and 18 rounds. Now, the rounds are divided up into three phases. Surprisingly, phase one, phase two, and phase three. Now, it is a fully cooperative game at the start, because everyone starts as a human, don't they?
Give or take, yes.
Well, mostly, the characters start as humans. I don't know for the actual humans sitting around the table. There's going to be a first player, and the first player will be assigned based on the character they're playing. The characters all have a certain number assigned to their character, and the lowest number will be the first player, which will be important for a couple of reasons, primarily because that person will always go first in the turn, and they will always be in charge of the camp event, which is what precedes every single round of this game. And then they will also have the power to decide who gets on or not on the chopper at the end, which could be a really important part of this game.
Get to the chopper.
Thank you. I was waiting for you to do that. Every player is going to start as a various character, and you'll have characters that have kind of unique abilities that you've got to scrounge around for, but you'll have doctors and fighters and scientists and just people with good leadership and blah, 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 blah. Somewhere between four and eight chosen characters, depending on the version of the game that you've got, and it does play up to six any given game. The way you're going to play, for the vast majority of this game, is that you're going to have five action cubes that you'll be able to use, which you'll be able to upgrade during the course of the game by earning XP.
And it does have one of those lovely player boards where things actually fit in the specific places. They're the two levels of player board, which is very, very nice.
Yes. So a turn will generally go relatively quickly. It's going to start with the camp event. And let's get this out of the way first of all, because it does kind of sometimes make the decision for you what you're going to be doing that particular round.
Yes.
So the first player is going to flip over the camp event. Now, there are, I think, when I counted, 27 camp event cards. They are going to consist of attacks from either crazy dogs or mad people or something like that, which is bad. Or they're going to consist of setbacks, which is something bad that's happening. It might be that your door has exploded or that your furnace has exploded or that the weather's too bad or something else. Or there's going to be an instant effect. Now, the rule is, when you flip that over, if it is an attack or a setback, which is terminology within the game, Each player on their turn will have to resolve that attack or setback during the course of their game. Their turn. If it is an instant, it happens straight away, going around in table order, you resolve the effect, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they could be things like the first player draws a card from one of the three applicable piles, looks at it, takes a card from their hand, passes it to the player to the left, and it goes round and round and round and round and stops when the last player does that very same thing. Or it could be that everyone has to discard a card, or everyone has to roll an action die and something happens. But they're pretty straightforward. The more important ones are these attacks and setbacks, because they require you to generally fight something or overcome a bad situation, which in itself then has a consequence if you have not been able to succeed. So, camp event will get played, you'll all go, ugh, or you'll go, because around about 30% of these camp event cards have this really small symbol in the corner that doesn't look particularly important, but it's a lock.
It seems a hell of a lot more than 30%.
It does, which is why I counted it last time.
Oh, God.
Now, this lock symbol means that you can't move around between the two primary locations of the board. And the primary locations are inside and outside.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, that sounds like it could be a bit important, but it really is super bloody important.
Yeah, yes.
And the reason it feels like more than 30% of the deck is because as soon as you get maybe two of those camp event cards in a row, or perhaps even three, oh boy, does it stifle the potential actions that you as a player can do.
Yes.
So let's lead into those actions. You can, on a turn, choose to move. Now, you can move between any of the available spaces as long as you can spend an action every time you do that, and you start with five actions. However, you can only ever move from inside to outside, or vice versa, once. Now, there are going to be items that you can equip and what have you later on down the track if you build them that might be able to save you those costs, but an action that you're generally going to do is to move somewhere because you want to do a thing. The thing you might want to do if you're inside is searching.
Oh, can you search through decks in this game?
You can search through decks.
Wow, I didn't realise.
You can actually search through three decks. Yeah. Because inside there is a workshop deck. There is another deck that is almost exactly the same.
Warehouse? Storage house?
Storage.
Yep.
And then each player has their own personal deck that is absolutely all about their particular character.
Which is excellent, because it is unique to the different eight different characters in it, and it is a very, very nice touch.
Exactly, and creates a good amount of replayability. Now, the decks that you're going to be drawing from, the warehouse and the storage one, they're going to contain your buildable items like your bits of wood and your bits of metal and your screws and bits of rope and all that kind of stuff. They'll also contain food, which is incredibly important at certain parts of the game. They might also include first aid kits, which are also incredibly important in the game. Mm-hmm. And your personal deck will continue to have some of those items, but it will also have more specific items. So, for example, I was a doctor, and I was able to have a lot of first aid kits into my own personal deck, but I was also able to have a couple of special cards that would allow me to either heal other people in the group, or maybe be able to do a blood test on them and just go, are you who you say you really are, Leon Thing Cannon?
That's most likely not my middle name.
So anyway, you're inside and you're going to be moving or searching. The other thing you can do is you can fix the boiler. The boiler is one of those items inside the room that will take damage, and usually it'll take damage because of an event card. It'll say take damage. If it takes three damage, bad things happen. Pretty simple. And that's kind of all you can do when you're inside.
And there's the door card on the outside.
Yeah.
Which you can fix the door, because you don't want the door to get blown in, because then you have to deal with bad weather conditions even on the inside. But for some reason, you can't fix the door when you're on the inside, only the outside.
Correct.
Because of reasons.
Indeed. So let's move this to the outside, because on the outside, you can't search for any of your items, because your items are all on the inside. That's where the storage in the warehouse is. But you do have the three phase decks. Now, they are called the Phase 1, Phase 2 and Phase 3, but they're not really, because...
No, that's not what they're called, Garth.
On the backs of these cards, in what can only be called a bizarre design choice...
A little bit of oversight, perhaps.
The card backs have P-001, P-002 and P-003. And everyone that sits down to play it, we've played it a couple of times now, go, why do those cards say poo?
Yes, yes. Why does that say poo one, poo two and poo three?
I thought you had to, like, go outside to poo because there's no space inside and no one wants the smelly poo inside.
And things have gotten so bad that to survive we have to search through poo to survive.
Correct. So you can go outside and you can search those decks. Now, that is incredibly important because that's how you're going to get XP.
Yes.
You are not able to get XP when you're inside because inside is easy. Doesn't matter what you do with the card. As long as you've actually dug in and tried to take one, you'll get 2 XP just for the privilege.
Yeah.
You can then reveal that card and it'll contain either something bad or something good. Good stuff could be take an item, which are incredibly important. You might get an axe or a knife or a sword or a flamethrower. Or you might get some more XP, which is great.
Or geographical material, which is extremely important.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. So the point is you're going to spend that XP on upgrading your character. You'll upgrade it by getting more actions, more stamina, which will affect how many dice you can roll, how many items you're able to carry. And then you've also got what's called the locker die, which is kind of a once per round special thing that your character might be able to do, depending on the face of the die that you've got face up.
And again, unique to your character.
Which is awesome. What's in that deck, though, unfortunately, is also quite a lot of badness.
Yeah.
Primarily the thing.
Yeah.
Which will start off not being incredibly scary because in phase one, you only need to roll one success to defeat the thing. And the way that you're going to be able to control that is by having as much stamina as possible. If you have four or more stamina, you'll be able to roll 2 die. And if you have some items, they're going to be able to help you against those attacks, or in fact against setbacks as well. So you'll generally be okay in phase one unless the dice gods are against you.
And Garth, did you mention these dice?
Well,
there's a lot of blank faces on these dice.
Well, there is a 50-50 chance on each of them. You've either got a flame side or a blank side. You need to roll as many flames as possible. I wouldn't want to be Will Wheaton, because no doubt he would just roll whole bunches of blank die. Some of us have experienced that wonder of rolling 5 die and getting nothing but blankness and losing to the thing. And that's bad.
And a lot of times I must admit, I feel like blank die faces are perhaps lazy design choices. In this, you do have that tension of it's 50% failure rate. What can I do to boost that up?
Yeah.
Particularly if you're down in your, what's the word for it? You know, that healthy thing.
Stamina.
Down in your stamina and you only get to roll 1 die. Mm. So it is really a 50-50 chance. In this game, I think it works having those blank faces.
I agree. And everyone is watching you. It's all really important. It's really, really cool. And if you don't succeed against the thing, it's bad.
Yeah.
And this is where the distrust is started to be sowed around this game because you have this seemingly innocuous deck. It's only made up of 12 cards. Most of them, in fact, 11 of them, have nothing on the other side.
Just blank.
Blank, but one of them has this bloody smear of smearing blood. And if you happen to be defeated by the thing, or if you happen to not find somebody to sleep with at the appropriate time of the game, you will have to draw a vulnerability card. And that is bad.
Mm.
Because vulnerability cards will mean that no one will trust you for the end ever, for the rest of the game.
Yes,
and that's and that's incredibly important. So if you defeat the thing, good stuff will happen. If you fail to defeat the thing, you'll draw that vulnerability card. You'll take a sneaky look at it. 11 times out of 12, you'll see nothing there. But occasionally, Mark will see a blood stain and know that he is now the host of the thing.
Yes.
And this is where the game can potentially start to become interesting because a couple of the other actions you can take are trading with people because I might have some wood and some metal that Leon needs to upgrade his hatchet to an axe, but I also might have had to draw a vulnerability card and I can't show anybody whether I'm the thing or not the thing, but Leon really needs this stuff because he really wants to upgrade his weapon so that he can be a killing machine.
Yeah.
But every time players interact in terms of trading, I need to show him whether I'm a goodie, as in a human, or a baddie, as in a thing, Mark. Now, the game comes with incredibly overproduced clickers that will signify this. They're about the size of, let's call it, a cigarette lighter, I guess, perhaps?
Yep, give or take.
And they've got a side which is green. You click that, and you'll see nothing but green, or they've got a side that is a blood smear, and that'll show you that you're infected.
Yes.
And every time two players interact, as long as one of them has a vulnerability card, they need to show those clickers. Now,
and also when they sleep together as well, they have to slow each other their clickers, which is something I've been doing for years, to be perfectly
honest. You've shown your clicker to everyone you sleep with?
Yeah, give or take.
Okay, well, that's as long as it's consensual, that's fine.
As far as I remember.
So every time that thing happens, the thing has a choice, Mark.
Has a choice.
You can choose as the thing to either infect this player, which is good, or you can choose to hide it. And that's really, really important because the thing, although it wants to spread and infect everybody, needs humans to survive on. So being able to infect everybody is not what the thing actually wants to do. So you do this lots.
I hear that's right.
You do this lots. And during the course of the game, there are three sleep phases where everyone needs to pair up. If you cannot pair up, then you are instantly vulnerable and you have to draw a card.
And if the vulnerability deck is done, you instantly take a wound.
Exactly. The other times you do it are when you trade, and there'll be other instances where it might happen. Now, this game just progresses along and along and along and along and along. It takes more penalties, I guess, if you are going into phase two and phase three. When you lose against the thing, more strikes will be dealt out, more vulnerabilities. Then you get to this helicopter phase, which is the end of the game.
Try and explain this, Garth.
Well, it comes in the form of four pages on the rule book.
It's so convoluted.
Correct. Now, the easy way to explain it is that the humans need to get on the chopper.
Yes.
And the humans want no things on the chopper.
Yes.
But the things want to get on the chopper.
Yes.
But they also need humans to be on the chopper so that they can eat and survive.
Yes, the thing character or the person who becomes the host can't flat out go, right, I'm the host now, I'm going to infect everyone on this table, and then I've won the game. No, because the thing needs to get on that helicopter so they can get back to civilization and infect the world.
Correct. And this is where whoever is the lowest player count, as in the number on their card, is the team leader, and they get to decide.
Yes.
Now, they get to choose to be the first person on the chopper, or they might choose to go, I'm not getting on the chopper yet. It's all in or nothing in. So, Mark, you are definitely not coming on the chopper.
Damn it.
Leon, I'll trust you. You're coming on the chopper. And
hooray.
Then we'll skedaddle.
I mean,
the reason that's important is because once that has been decided and the chopper door is closed, then we're going to reveal who's human and who is dead. Everyone will get their clickers, put it onto the applicable human side or the thing side, turn it over, and then a number's going to be calculated, which is six times the number of human players.
Yes.
Doesn't matter whether the human players are dead or alive.
Yes.
Doesn't matter whether they are on the helicopter or not. That's the number. So if there are three human players, the base is 18.
Yes.
That's what you need to get. You'll then minus any of the helicopter parts, which are cards that you've drawn, for the people who are on the chopper who are actually humans, and that'll take it down from 18 to 15, 13, 12, 10, 8, 7, however many parts the human players have been able to get.
Yep.
And then they get one dice roll per person.
Indeed.
Which is a standard D6 in that it has numbers 1 through to 6 on it, but arguably one of the most overproduced dice that gets rolled the least amount of times in a game.
Yep.
And then depending on how the roll is, if they succeed in this helicopter bonus or don't, the human players win or they don't.
Yes, and the host player or one of the infected could possibly be on the helicopter, and anything that they have points-wise from the die roll or whatever else will negatively affect that final score.
Correct.
So it's just that simple, people.
So there you go.
Four easy pages of a rulebook that's like 7 pages long.
We're 27 minutes into the episode, and I've explained the game.
Yeah.
Guys, what do we reckon?
This game had so much promise.
Yep.
You know, the art, the story, the theme. I know Aiden, before he'd even got it, he was talking about this game coming, you know, the excitement, the paranoia, the fear, the production values. It had so much going for it.
Yes, it did. And it doesn't deliver on them?
No.
And there's a couple of key things. This game is so close. It is probably 70 to 75%. Really quite good.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of things. Now, the first thing that immediately springs to mind are these bloody camp event cards. Not that they're bad. It's that lock symbol.
Yes, it's ridiculous.
Because if you happen to be stuck inside, then all you're going to do is search over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. But conversely, if you are stuck outside, we played with five players. Now, this game goes up to 6. The decks, the poo decks, or right. Phase 1, Phase 2, Phase 3 decks,
yep.
They might run out after maybe 2 rounds of 3 yep. or 4 players being outside. Now, the players might not want to actually be outside, but they're locked. Yes. They're locked out. They can't go anywhere else. The decks just disappear, and then you're not going to be able to access the next phase of the game until another 5 turns from now, potentially. Yeah.
And look, I'm surprised as Leon was about the fact that only a third of them had the lock, because it felt like way more than that. It felt like more than a half. And the thing is, you know, you need... I don't know if you mentioned, like, unlocking those extra slots on your player boards, which are amazing. You know, you can unlock an extra stamina cube. You can unlock an extra action. You've got a special... Each character's got a special ability that they can unlock. You can unlock that locker dice. You can unlock extra slots for equipment. But all of that costs XP, and the only way you can get XP was to be outside. Yes. And so a number of times we... Because you go outside where you take damage to your stamina just by being outside.
Mm.
So you've got to go back inside every now and again to warm up, basically, and get your health back. And then to be stuck in there and not be able to go outside, you can only search.
Well, I was stuck inside, I think, for 3 straight rounds. And I already had... your hand limit's only 5 in this game, mm-hmm. Until you can unlock some slots to give you some more. I had 5 good cards in my hand. Didn't want any more. I'd had some food so I could survive the food... asking bit of the rim. I wasn't going to share with anybody because there was 1 or 2 people I was pretty convinced were good,
yep.
Other 2 that I weren't, so I wasn't going to share with anybody.
No.
All I needed was XP, but I was stuck inside for 3 whole rounds.
Which feels like an eternity. Oh, yeah.
Because all you do on other people's turns, you can look at what they do, but you're not doing anything whatsoever. You're kind of interested in what they do. But as I've written down here, the first thing, this is the first ever deck searching game, because that's all you're doing is searching through decks, turn after turn after turn after turn. And like I said, once you've got your character in a pretty good state and you've got a fair idea of who you think the good guys and the bad guys are, there's not really much else you can do except kind of wait to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And something we hadn't mentioned is you can attack other people. So yes. If you start thinking, oh...
Well, you're not attacking other people, you're attacking the thing.
Yes, so if you start thinking, I think Mark's a bad guy, I can attack him. And if I've got
I'm not, Leon.
If I've got like a decent amount of stamina and a good gun or something, I could... kill him, and he'll be out of the game. So this game has player elimination. If he was a good guy or a bad guy, because you cannot defend yourself in a combat. You cannot defend yourself. Mm. So if somebody has, I say, if somebody has 2 items and their stamina is at least 4 cubes, you will die.
Yeah.
And that's it. If you're a good guy, it means your pluses won't add to the end, but people have to still have to deal with your 6 points for being a human player. And if you're a bad guy, I mean... Again, you won't find out to the end, so that's good for the good guys, but then that person has to sit out, as you 2 did, because we killed both of your evil thing people. But you guys had to sit there for the last 40 minutes of the game.
Correct.
Which was very similar to our thing of Altiplano, that the last half an hour was actually all right, because the game sped along, because there was only 3 people left, and yeah. Oh, and also we should mention, we played the long game.
Yep.
Don't ever, ever, ever play the long game in this, because 15 rounds would have been probably a bit too many, and we played 18. It was...
And look, let's mention the minis. The minis are really lovely in this. Yep. I mean, it's certainly...
The production qualities, full stop, yeah, are incredible.
It certainly helps that our friend Aiden has painted them. And if you check out Instagram or Twitter, I've posted a couple of photos of the work that Aiden's done. But even without the paint, the minis do look really well. You know, the art style in the game, it's sort of that... bit Tintin-y looking art, which I really like. But, yeah, it just runs out of puff really quickly. You've got the Board Game Geek page here, Garth. I can't believe this game is rated 8.0 on Board Game Geek. Now, I'm sure there's many people who probably haven't even got it to the table yet and maybe have already rated it based on what they feel from the look of the game.
I mean, component quality, it's higher than 8.10, but that don't mean anything.
So anyway, look, we need to kind of wrap this up. It's sort of in that vein of Wasteland Express, which you talked about a couple of weeks ago, which it just looks like it should deliver so much more, and it just doesn't. You need to...
But this is even
Make this really sort of strip it back and remove a couple of components, change some things around. And there is a good game potentially in there, but it's just not this at the moment.
I think it's even more egregious than Wasteland, because I think this game looks even better, but it's worse in the sense that it can get boring, and we can't even describe how much of a convoluted mess that ending is. It's absolutely insane.
All right, so that's our talk on Who Goes There by Certifiable Games. Mark, throw us to a song, and then we'll come back and talk about some other stuff. You're with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio, 99.3 FM.
The dulcet tones of the Beastie Boys there. I Want Some on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh here in Hobart on a cold Thursday night. I want some of that shelf of games they've got in Area 52, actually. There's a couple there I've really got my eye on.
I know. It's pretty good, isn't it?
I think there's probably some of the ones that Leon's going to talk about. In this next segment, I've called Leon Sits on the Couch.
Oh, that's one of my favourite things that has to be said. What I wanted to do, because we did Wasteland last week and we've done Who Goes There this week, I think it's the first time possibly ever in over 200 episodes we've done back-to-back disappointments. It's not really our thing. We're rather positive lads around here. So what I wanted to talk about was, since Who Goes There is based off the Thing film, I wanted to talk about other board games that are based off either TV or movies. And I just thought we could do a quick, you know, top three, basically, of what we thought. So I thought I'd go that. I'll kick us off, but I'll kick us off with an honourable mention. I thought we'd get them out of the way first, because I think we've all got about four.
Yep.
My honourable mention is Spartacus, which is based off the TV show.
But I'm Spartacus.
No, I'm Spartacus.
Not the film, the TV show that was out a few years ago, which I was a real big fan of.
And you do look good in a loincloth.
As has to be said. So in this game, you're running a gladiatorial school, and you've got to recruit different gladiators to fight. You also recruit different slaves, which, you know, they were slaves back
not
then.
Not for kids.
What's
no.
it called? It's got a special name. Dominari or...?
I can't remember. It's Dominus, something like that. That's the name of the person that runs it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Either way, where this game kind of fell down is you actually got to do the gladiator combat, and it's not the greatest in the world. There's an arena board. It's got like a bloodstain on it. It's all kind of cool. That's the kind of bit that falls down. But there's bidding stuff for the new gladiators and how you run your school and resource type of stuff. That was good, but it fell out a bit in the combat, which is why it's only the honourable mention.
Well, you can't chop off the heads and the legs and have the blood spraying all over the camera and all that stuff like you did in the TV show.
Well, you possibly could.
Well, look, I've got an honourable mention. Now, I have spoken about this game before. It is the DC Deck Builder game. And specifically I'm putting this in for the Arrowverse. So I have the Arrow TV show expansion. I don't think there's a Flash TV show expansion yet. But interestingly, in the Arrow expansion you've got pictures from the TV show, whereas all the rest of the game is cartoony art from DC, of course.
Yes, and it's the one expansion I don't own because of that alone.
Yeah, look,
which is a shame, because as you've told me before, the actual mechanics of it and those characters are awesome,
yeah,
but it just don't look right.
Yeah, well, and again, you know, it mixes it up, but it is, you know, because if you have been a fan of the Arrow, and I was for the first few seasons, you know, they've always got these secrets from each other that you gradually get uncovered, and part of the mechanics when you use that expansion is you take cards and you put them under your hero and they come back to bite you, or they come back and you can use them. So it fits in with the TV theme. So that was my honourable mention, the DC Deck Builder, and specifically for the Arrowverse.
Well, there you go. Now, I didn't have one, but I'll put out K2, which is clearly an adaptation of Cliffhanger, the movie.
Okay.
That's a stretch.
How about Everest? Everest the movie, then.
Okay.
They're both mountains.
Sure.
Either way, let's move on. You've made a shamble to this entire segment.
Fine. How about Hey, That's My Fish and Happy Salmon, which are based on the BBC documentary Wild
March of the Pink. Yeah, okay. That is fine. Okay, so let's actually move on to our top three. So, number three, I have Game of Thrones, which, yes, is a book series, but also a very popular TV series. Hand of the King, which is a tiny, tiny little set collection game that you can play with children, anybody, that takes about 10 minutes or so, but it's an absolute belter.
It is a really good implementation of a really simple bunch of mechanics, which thematically just really, really works with the whole Game of Thrones universe.
And the art is spectacular. We actually mentioned before, Mark, about possibly getting a second version each of this game.
Yes, and
either framing them or somehow making them like coasters, because they're about the same size as a coaster. Yeah. And that would be awesome, because for less, it's like $15 this game, maybe 20 at a stretch. And for what's in it, it's awesome.
I think it's Miho, isn't it? The same guy who did the art for the Raiders of the North Sea?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's very similar. Very similar.
Very distinctive looking, really attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So me, you frackin' toasters, I picked Battlestar Galactica.
Fantastic.
It's the ultimate hidden trader game. Yes, it goes a bit long, but, you know, look, talk about a game where it lives up to and exceeds the expectations based on the property. You know, you've got the tension and the drama and the Cylons and the characters. And yes, you've got a lot of expansions that you don't really need, but
maybe
Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, look, Battlestar with the right group of people and the right number of drinks and the right attitude is hilarious and tense and funny.
Yep.
And when you've got a president or an admiral or a pres-admirable who's also a Cylon directing the ships into oblivion, it's great. It still stands up because it is, God knows how old now, Mark. It must be almost...
What do you look at me when it's all about old?
Well, you know, you're deteriorating faster than we are. But, yeah, good choice there. So I'm going to start with number three with a bit of Alien Encounters Legendary, is one of the best fully co-op sort of deck-building games out there. It replays all four movies, allows you to mish-mosh them all together and create your own alien story. The player mat is amazing.
Yes.
The box comes with so much empty space in it, which clearly needs to be filled up with other parts of the Legendary Encounters game that you can expand and then have, I don't know, Buffy fighting an alien, fighting Captain America.
But there's also Predator. There's also flat out just the Alien expansion.
Is
there then also Predator, as you said, which is designed to go together.
Correct. So that game is bloody tough.
Yes.
If not brutally so. Throw in an Alien Queen expansion and the human players, I dare say, will not win. It's really quite simple.
We've never won that game, have we?
It is so much fun playing it together with the right group of people. It's tough.
Yeah. Okay, number two.
Come on down.
Indeed. I've got a game which we haven't talked about on the show yet, so I'll be brief with it because we might do a full talk about it one day, which is The Godfather Corleone's Empire, which I only played recently this year, came out, I think, last year, and it recreates basically the gang wars of the first Godfather and to somewhat the second Godfather film. Apparently they made a third one, but we don't speak about that. And it's about moving your characters around the board and shaking down various businesses and controlling different boroughs of New York. And it's pretty much what you want from a gangster type game. And it's to link with, you know, this is the best kind of gangster IP out there, essentially. So mixing those two together, and it works, and it works well.
Yeah, I can't wait to get it back to the table.
It sure does, and it comes with a horse head first player marker, so that's pretty cool. Look, it feels a similar niche to Tammany Hall for me, because you're basically, you know, in Tammany Hall, you're trying to vie for powers of the various New York boroughs sort of, you know, a long time earlier than The Godfather was set. But, yeah, this game is really, really cool. Really simple to play as well. Like, mechanically, it's really straightforward. Looks fantastic. The minis are great. And, yeah, you never really know who's winning because every time you get money, it goes into your little secret, what is it, a suitcase or whatever?
Which is a tin, a metal tin that you get, which is very nice. But, yeah, as you said, it's one of those games that I haven't played this now in probably about 2 months. We could put it on the table right now. I could tell you all the rules, guarantee you, which is something that many games these days, that the rules are out the head straight away.
Correct.
Well, my number two might be a bit of a surprise, although I'm pretty sure I've talked about this one on the show. Harry Potter Hogwarts Battle. It's the Harry Potter deck building game that I picked it up because it was reasonably cheap. And one of the games I wanted to use to get my new partner into gaming. We have loved it. We played it with my son as well. We have played. So you've got the seven books and you basically unlock new cards as you go through the seven books, new villains, new abilities.
But they are specifically based more on the films because they use the art from the films, don't they?
Yes.
Well, the photos from the films. Like, there's nothing, there's no characters in it that are just from the books that aren't in the films, I believe.
Well, I don't think so, because, yeah, you're right. They have the photo art from the movies, absolutely. Okay. And look, I had never watched any other Harry Potter movies apart from the very first one ages and ages and ages ago. We've actually now started to watch, Sarah and I, watch the Harry Potter movies, because we've gone, oh, that character ability looks really interesting for that person. We don't know who he is. Let's watch the movie and find out what the story is.
They are good films.
We have had a lot of fun with Harry Potter Hogwarts Battle. There is an expansion. Not sure if I'm going to pick it up. That adds monsters, gives you new villains, gives you new cards, but it's been a lot of fun.
Well, there you go. Well,
there was a group at BorderCon that pretty much played nearly through the entire game this year.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So my number two is a game we talked about last week, so it only needs a brief discussion. Firefly.
Yes.
Arguably one of the best implementations of a thematic pick-up-and-deliver game. It's actually a game that I prefer with all the bits included.
Make it a long, good game.
Make it big, make it long, make it shiny, go for it. It's a space opera. It's
and
really
look,
lovely.
I was also going to pick Firefly, but for the other Firefly game, which I love, the legendary Encounters, a Firefly deck-building game, which quite different to the Alien one.
In the fact that it has the worst art you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah, well, apart from that, but it's a lot of fun, and it really evokes the theme of the TV show and the movie.
Okay, good to know.
Okay, and finally, number one. So I've got a game. I've mentioned it a few times sporadically through the years on this show. If we ever did a top five games that people need to play a hell of a lot more, this would be maybe my number one, and that is Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah,
based off the TV show, that there's about to be a new TV show called The Mayans, which is a spin-off from the original Sons of Anarchy show, which a lot of people were really big fans on. And this is for if you have a group that like we do, like games where you like to screw over everybody, like you're nothing personals and stuff like that, get Sons of Anarchy to the table. It's not that expensive. It's got lots of different colourful bits for all the different gangs and stuff. You've only got a certain amount of locations, and you're just sending whole lots of bikers there to try and claim them to get the various resources, and then at the end, you all reveal big stacks of money and guns and contraband and stuff, and it's pretty simple to the point. Good amount of variability because there's different locations for every different time you play, and it's one of those things. This is a game that puts, because it's Gale Force 9, mm-hmm. same guys that did Firefly.
Yep.
So Firefly, everyone thought, oh, a good IP game. It's probably a fluke. Then they did Sons of Anarchy and everyone went, ooh. And those two games combined are the reason that people give them IPs at the drop of a hat now.
Yeah.
Because they can trust them to actually go, no, we're going to care for them. We're going to get the theme squeezed every single bit of it we can. And, yeah, so Sons of Anarchy, get it to
the table.
And
we just talked about them last week or the week before, picking up the June IP, so can't wait to see that.
Yeah, I haven't played Sons of Anarchy yet. We were meant to play it a couple of years ago with some listeners at BorderCon, but just couldn't make it happen. Yeah. So
my number one, I'm taking a little bit of artistic license because, look, there's definitely TV shows, multiple. There's definitely movies. Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, I don't know that I have to say any more.
No.
It's a fantastic game.
Yes.
Yes.
And a book series, of course.
All right. Well, let's turn this back to...
I just heard today that Robert Downey Jr. is getting ready to start production on Sherlock Holmes 3.
Guy Ritchie again?
No, apparently it's not Guy Ritchie. Oh. I don't know who's directing it, but both him...
Madonna. She got it in the divorce.
Downey Jr. and Jude Law are returning.
Well, there you go. So let's talk about a real game now. Star Wars Rebellion. If there's going to be a Star Wars game, Star Wars Rebellion is the grand space opera of them all. You're not just fighting a Battle of Hoth. You're not just fighting a tiny little game. You're not even just having one space battle like you are in, I don't know, X-Wing, and you're not going up a little bit of a scale in Armada. You are the whole Rebellion versus the whole Galactic Empire. It says 2-4. It's just a two-player game.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. This game is brilliant and possibly one of the best two-player games in our entire hobby. It is a damn shame it's just a pasted-on four-player version because a proper awesome Star Wars space battle four-player game would be amazing.
Yeah. So that's it. That's the best one, clearly.
Yeah. Okay, so that's our positivity for this week out of the way.
We'll come back with a bit more in just a few moments.
Hello, everyone. Sorry to interrupt, but it is your friendly neighbourhood Leon here. I just wanted to take a few seconds to remind our old listeners and to all our new that you can support The Dice Men Cometh on Patreon. You can jump over to thedicemencometh.com and there is a link sitting there on the front page. You can give as little or as much as you want every month, and we are very, very appreciative. I myself do it for several different podcasts, and a dollar or two comes out and I don't even notice. And I can tell you right now that if everyone listening to my voice right now only gave us a dollar every month, we would be very, very happy, lads. And every cent that you spend goes straight back into the show. We've been using it, as well as the advertising from our lovely sponsors, to go all around Australia to see you guys at every convention we can get our hands on, and hopefully we might even be doing it internationally soon, so watch this space. Also, you could jump over to redbubble.com and search for Dice Men, and you can get our logo onto all different kind of merchandise. We ourselves have them on t-shirts and hoodies and coffee cups and stuff, and they're really cool, and that's another way you can support us as well. The show has grown leaps and bounds in the last year or so, and it is thanks to the effort and support of you lovely people out there. You keep giving and keep giving us material, and we will keep doing the show. So, love to all of you, and now back to the action.
1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6, 7. You're with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. That was Jet, Beat on Repeat. Now, to wrap this up, Mark, tell us about a short little party game that you've been playing lately.
In December 1956, paroled rebel Fidel Castro returned to Cuba to launch his revolution with virtually no political base and, after a disastrous initial encounter with government forces, a total of just 12 good men. 2 years later, through masterful propaganda and factional manoeuvre, Castro, his brother Raúl, and iconic revolutionary Che Guevara had united disparate guerrillas and exploited Cubans' deep opposition to their dictator Fulgencio Batista y Zaldívar. Castro's takeover of the country became a model for leftists in surgery.
Insurgency. Oh, getting my left insurgery's removed.
Insurgency. So, Cuba Libre. This is the second in the GMT coin or counterinsurgency series.
It's a slight odd theme for a party game.
Designed by Volko Runke, the coin master. And this one is Jeff Grossman, published in 2013. So first they had Andean Abyss. It's Cuba Libre or Cuba Libre. Is the second one. So it's 1 to 4 players. It depicts insurgent and counterinsurgent conflict in Cuba from 1957 to 1958. And each player takes the role of a faction seeking to run Cuban affairs. You've got the government, or you've got 1 to 3 insurgent factions. You've got the leftist movement, 26 July, or M26,
yeah,
with Fidel and his group. You've got the anti-communist, anti-Batista, revolutionary directorio.
Yeah.
Just DR. And you've got the organized crime syndicate now using military, political, and economic actions and exploiting various events. Players build and maneuver forces to influence the population, extract resources, or otherwise achieve their faction's aim. Now, of course, you've got Castro's 26 July movement. They've got to expand from their bases down south in the Sierra Maestra Mountains to fight their way north to Havana. Meanwhile, the anti-communist student groups, urban guerrillas, and expatriates, known as the Revolutionary Directorate, they try to destabilize the Batista regime from inside and out, while trying not to pave the way for a new dictatorship under Castro. Batista's government has to maintain steam to counter this twin insurgency, while, of course, getting support from its fragile US alliance and being skimmed and skimming the corrupt syndicate bosses. And in the midst of that, you've got the corrupt syndicate bosses jockeying to keep their Cuban gangster paradise alive. I think there's a song in that.
Mm.
Now, coin game. They've got a fabulous rule book. Now, of course, it's very daunting when you first look at it.
Yes.
But it's the GMT 1.1.1.A.
The rule books are exceptionally written.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of detail in the rules, but knowing where to find stuff is amazing. There's also a playbook which has some really great tutorials. So you can sit down by yourself or with a friend or with four friends, play through this and get an idea. Now, they are a heavy game.
Yes.
However,
no.
If you have played a heavy or even a middling to heavy Euro, you can play these games. You've got to invest a little bit of time to get into them. And what we have found, Garth, you and I particularly,
Our friend Tim, that we met at BorderCon, has been fantastic in teaching us a couple of these games. And so if you've got someone that knows the coin system, and whilst they do change from game to game a little bit, they are quite similar. The main mechanic is you have your four factions. You flip over a card. The card will have the four faction symbols across the top in various orders. That will indicate who gets to go first, or the player order. Mm-hmm. And then in player order, you decide, are you going to do one of two events that are on the card, which are usually special thing and tied to historical actions, or are you going to use the opportunity to do operations, which is where you can do all the actions that you need to do to build up your troops or move them around or do some attacking or blow some stuff up or some, you know, do some guerrilla sneaking into the city. Or if you're a mob, open a new casino, take cash from one casino to another one, move them around. You can do that. Sometimes if you do the operation, then the second faction can do a limited operation, which means they can do one of those things in only one spot. Or if the first person wants to do the event, then a second person can do an operation. It's this little chart where you move your little markers across, and only two of the four players will get to do something.
And it's incredibly important, because another really powerful action is deciding to pass.
Yes.
Because you don't just see the one card that's in play, you see the next one that's leading up to it, and you might see, oh, my flag is the very first one, which means it's going to be my benefit to hold off and do this really powerful event, but I have to forego a whole turn right now where I could do. This is the essence of the coin series for me, and the coin mechanic is that the ebb and flow of I can choose to go and I can choose to do something really powerful, or I can choose to hold off and see what the opponents are going to do. It's really tense and exciting. Now, this game goes for around about 3 to 4 hours, and it's considered kind of the introductory version of coin.
And look at this one, you've got the propaganda card. So we played Falling Sky before, where at the end of the sort of you had the winter round where you sort of you check if someone wins and then you do some sort of other stuff. In this game, it's the propaganda cards. You've got 48 event cards. You basically make them into four decks, and you shuffle a propaganda card into each of those four decks, put it back into the one deck. So like we did, we had two propaganda cards within three cards.
Yeah.
Or you could get 16 cards without them. And so you're trying to time your win, because everyone has a different win condition, very asymmetric. You're trying to time your win to be when the propaganda card is going to come, but you just don't know when. Look, I love these games. I really want to get more of them to the table. I've still got Andy and Abyss that I haven't tried.
Yeah, Colonial Twilight and Pendragon are sitting at home that I haven't got yet.
Look, if you're holding off because these games are scaring you, Cuba Libre is the perfect one to start with.
Yep, 100%. And it is, once you get one coin game under your belt, it's actually not that difficult. Yeah. The key is, and the strategy I've employed in the couple I've played, which I've also won, is every single turn, every single action you're doing, always focusing on what's going to actually get me victory and who is my closest rival. So how can I do something that will get me victory while limiting them? Because it's so transparent where everyone is on the victory track, which I love about the coin game series. You can see exactly the amount of points that each of my opponents is on, and I can see where I need to get to. So what a great game. So much fun. Thank you to Tim and Steve for playing it with us at Winter Games Fest a couple of weeks ago.
Now, surprise, surprise, we've run out of time. That's all there is for this week. Thank you so much to Area 52 for your support. Thank you so much to everyone out there for listening. We'll be back next week with way, way more than we can ever squeeze in, as usual.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to another episode of The Dice Men Cometh. Thanks to Area 52, Hobart's best ventilated game store, and more. Find out more on area52.com.au. They support The Dice Men, and you can too, at Patreon, for as little as just $1 per month. It's not a lot to ask for podcasting gold.